will be voting on a proposed Pacifica bylaws amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the pacifica.org website.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Juneteenth is fast approaching, and folks across the DMV, including WPFW and others nationwide, will honor this day and its meaning and the ma'afa associated with it. Dr. Denise Wright joins us to give us a hint about WPFW's programming on June 19th. Cornell West, in his bid for presidency, is now running as an independent rather than as a Green Party candidate. In an open letter to Dr. West, Ishmael Reed, poet, novelist, playwright, and activist, has in many ways posed whether West's bid is harmful to American politics, specifically the outcome of the election. Journalist John Jeter is here with us to discuss Reed's op-ed and the implications on Black voting. Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. My name is Denise Young and I am your host for the second Wednesday edition of the show. WPFW family, brace yourselves. We have another epic conversation for you this morning. And I say that every week. I know that I do, but every week I mean it. But before we get to our discussion about the op-ed piece, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk with Sister Denise Wright, who will be co-hosting with me next week for a special broadcast. Dr. Wright, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I am well, thank you, on this sunny, very sunny Wednesday morning. So as you heard, or, you know, we are, well, you know already that we're going to be co-hosting next week, which I am so excited to do that with you because I just think you are so dynamic. But, you know, as we're talking or as we're introducing this show, you know, I am curious if you have any comments about if you had a chance to read the op-ed that Ishmael Reed wrote as an open letter to Dr. Cornell West.
No, I have not had a chance to review it. I know this is in regards to him running for president, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I thought it was very interesting that, you know, you have this open letter and, you know, people are reading it. But at the end of the day, you know, I look at people like Cornell West and others and how we need to be more strategic in terms of what we're doing in the country right now.
Okay.
You know, we need to be more concentrated, I think, on the state and local level, because that's where a lot of changes are being made. People are being moved out of these different electoral positions. They're changing policy, and that inadvertently affects the health of the whole nation. And so, you know, him running for president, I'm not clear on what the motivation is. I mean, people always have their different opinions about what should be happening. Right, but I do honestly think that we really need to be looking at what's going on in the local and state level. I mean, even if we look at things happening right now in the district, there are a lot of policy changes with regard to the crime bill, housing, and all that other kind of stuff. You know, these things pop up and people say, you know, oh, geez, I don't know. You know, they complain, but they don't go to the meetings. They don't go to the hearings, you know. So you have to be really, really focused on that. And people who, you know, like Cornell West and others can be in a better position to do to affect change. You know, if we kind of look at, come up with some type of strategy that's really going to have some different outcomes.
So, you know, one of the reasons that I thought to even ask you what you thought about it was just because of, you know, the work that you are doing, the work that you've talked about. Can you tell, just, you know, so that our WPFW fam knows who they are listening to, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I guess so. Right? I'm trying to stay under the radar.
I'm
a psychologist by trade, and I've worked in different sectors, particularly in the city. with Department of Behavioral Health, you know, DCPS, the council, you know, and when you look at all these things interwoven together, you see some of the changes. I've been here over 30 years. Mm-hmm. So I came here from the Midwest. I'm originally from Ohio. And so when you're here for an extended period and you see some of the changes, you know, I really miss the old DC. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah. Well, your point about the local policies, you know, sort of just popping up. I mean, like one of the things that we know, and you mentioned it, is that we have seen these new, you know, in the name of safety, community safety, they're right. Essentially crime bills. So we know that DC has one, Prince George's County has one, the state of Maryland has one, and I believe that Virginia has one or is working on one. And you know, having spoken with members of sort of Young People for Progress, Danielle Blocker, who's executive director and for that shop, you know, has been talking about these crime bills popping up. And so I think what it indicates is exactly what you're saying, that we really have to pay attention to local politics. And I'm not saying that, you know, we ignore by any stretch of the imagination what's happening at the national level. But what we do know is that if we aren't paying attention, if we aren't giving attention and commitment and dedication at the local level, whatever we do at the national level, you know, particularly if we are trying to affect change, we just won't have the support to do it. We just
right,
won't.
Right. And it's really, really important that people are educated about what's going on. So say, for example, you have all these different crime bills popping up. It would be nice to have all the crime bills side by side and see how similar they are.
Oh, my goodness.
Similar. You know, how, you know.
How about that?
How do they inadvertently affect, you know, everyone, folks in the community? Has there been any change in terms of incarceration or, you know, people being on probation? I mean, people could be on probation for 10 years.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the reason I even mentioned Danielle Blocker and her group, and I don't mean to say her group, but the group that she is serving as executive director, is that, you know, Young People for Progress, you know, was paying particular attention to the crime bills here in the state of Maryland and looking elsewhere, you know, across the bridge, because what they understand is that there is a component in these crime bills that is targeting young people. And so what does that mean? That really means young Black people.
Right.
What it will definitely mean is young Black men. So, so absolutely this, you know, we need to be paying attention to what's happening.
But let me say this, there's nothing new up under the sun.
As we know.
There's nothing new up under the sun. This is a big world offer.
Nothing new.
So
thank you for jumping in on that in, you know, such an impromptu manner, because it occurred to me that I knew that you would have a word for, so I thank you. So, right. but you and I get to co-host next week, so I'm so excited about it.
I am too.
Why don't you tell our WPFW family what's happening next week?
Well, you know, I am personally involved with the National Juneteenth Festival group, and that's, you know, Tommy Blanton and Gina Avery and Angela. We're putting together a setup over there at the African American Civil War Memorial. And so there's going to be a lot of festivities over there. We're going to have vendors and things of that nature. We're still looking for vendors and food trucks. And then Frank Smith is going to be reading off the names, I think starting at 11. And hopefully we'll have a remote over there. Yes. And there's also the National Juneteenth Foundation group, and they're supposed to be at the Martin Luther King Memorial and making a march to the ellipse. So I think there's some things with that, but yeah, they're supposed to be doing that. And there's just going to be a lot of festivities going on during that day. I'm also involved with the Mount Zion Cemetery. They're going to be having a big cleanup over there. So there's going to be a lot of different activities and things that people can do as a family and as a community to commemorate this day.
Oh, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you something though, Denise.
Sure.
What was the thing? Did you find out anything else about the Juneteenth celebration at the White House? Did you find out any other additional information?
I do not have another piece of information.
Just wondering.
Yeah. So we are, maybe on Juneteenth, we'll know.
Maybe somebody will call in and give us the info.
Give us the 411 on that. So sister, I am so excited that we'll be able to co-host that together. And so for you listeners, our WPFW family, we do hope that you will join us for a special edition of What's at Stake on Juneteenth, starting at 9 a.m. We are going to go for 2 hours broadcasting, and we will definitely have some incredible people that we are going to be talking to who are going to be offering, you know, not just information about the specific day and its meaning, but really giving context to the Ma'afa, you know, meaning the genocide that we as Africans in this country and throughout the diaspora have endured, and you know, what that looks like, you know, in politics and relative to education, relative to so many things, relative to the Black experience. And so we do hope that you join us on Juneteenth for that special broadcast. Sister Denise, we're gonna make sure that you all know on that day, you know, as we're going back and forth between Denise and Denise, we're gonna make sure.
That's right. We share the same name. We can
I gotta
show up for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So anything else you wanna add about
everybody needs to have a lovely day. Be kind to yourself, give yourself grace. And that's about it. So I'm out.
Oh, absolutely. Well, peace and blessings to you, Sister Denise. And I will see you, hear you next week on Juneteenth at 9 a.m.
Okay, thank you. I'll talk to you.
Okay, bye-bye. I tell you, WPFW, you can tell from her energy and probably our mixed energy that we are going to have a fabulous broadcast next week. So I really do hope that our family and our listeners, that you all join us, support us. It's going to be an amazing broadcast. So switching gears ever so slightly to you know, the topic at hand that I introduced earlier, you know, which is this op-ed that Ishmael Reed wrote as an open letter to Dr. West about his bid for presidency. And when I read it, I have to say, I mean, and let me just say this at the top of the show, for anyone listening, I have the utmost respect for both Dr. Cornel West. In fact, I've had the honor of meeting him. And I think that he is a incredible human being, an incredible scholar. And I also have the utmost respect for Ishmael Reed, having, when you think about his, the plethora of work, when you think of what he has already over so many decades put into the world for us to read from us, for us to learn from, for us to grow, as thinkers, as doers in this country, but also specifically within our community and amongst each other, you can't help but to admire and respect Ishmael Reed. So I wanted to say that at the top of the show. Having said that, I believe, I think as Ishmael Reed is writing his op-ed, that I think that all of us, that we can can come and have a critical discussion about the things that we do, the things that we say, and particularly those of us who are in the public eye, and especially when we're talking about politics. And I could not think of a better person to have this conversation with than my brother, John Jeter, who I just think is an incredible journalist. I think his writing is majestic, and I love this brother's commitment to our narrative. So good morning and welcome, John.
Thank you so much, Denise. You know, it is one of the great joys of my life to chop it up with you. So
yes, and we have chopped it up a few times on What's at Stake. So thank you again for coming out this morning. So Ishmael Reed wrote a very interesting op-ed.
It is interesting. It really is. And I echo a couple of things. I echo your respect for both Dr. West and Ishmael Reed, who I discovered, both of whom I discovered more than 30 years ago, beginning with Ishmael Reed's novels back when I was in my novel reading period, which I'm no longer in, and Cornel West with his publication of Race Matters, which, while I wouldn't say it was a transformative book for me, it really deepened my education into radical Black politics. Although I don't think anyone would describe Cornel West as a radical, but still, the ideas that he expressed really kind of deepened my learning curve. So I have profound respect for both men. I really do. And I would say that Ishmael Reed is probably, or at least I thought of him, I'd say up until maybe about 10 years ago, I think of him as probably America's greatest living essayist. I think he's a great essayist.
Oh, yes.
Even more than his novels.
Yes, absolutely.
In the tradition of James Baldwin. But I'm troubled by a couple of things. One is this op-ed in the Amsterdam News, I thought, reflects this sort of vote blue no matter who sensibility.
Yes.
And I don't think that really elevates the conversation. You know, Denise, we've talked about this a lot. You're from Chicago. I've lived in Chicago. And the election of Harold Washington as the first Black mayor of that city in 1983 is really the sort of culmination, the pinnacle of radical Black political thought, where the city of Chicago, Black people in the city of Chicago, realize that if they continue to vote for the old Mayor Daley Democratic machine, that they would they might be frozen in the city of Pompeii, right?
Yeah.
They might
just be inundated
with snow and trash, that the city failed to pick up. And so they decided, that democracy means doing more than just going to vote every 4 years. You have to really engage the process. So they identified a congressman named Harold Washington, and they raised money to elect him, and they drove each other to the polls. And they made sure that Harold Washington came to the housing projects to talk to the people, and he was elected barely. And he was a transformative mayor who unfortunately dropped dead of a heart attack right after he was elected for a second term. I think had he lived, he might very well have been the most transformative mayor, certainly of the 20th century. But Ishmael Reed's piece, I think, repeats this sort of, I think, very wrongheaded idea that Cornel West, number one, is going to lead his candidacy for president will lead to the election, the re-election of Donald Trump. And that Trump is more dangerous than Joe Biden. I don't believe either of those are true. I don't think that Cornel West is going to somehow take voters away from Joe Biden. I think the voters who vote for Cornel West, if he's on the ballot, and that's part of the issue with Cornel West, is will he be on the ballot in many of these states? But I think those voters, if they don't vote for Cornel West, many of them will just stay home. And the other thing I think is, and I think this is the, this really gets to the root of the wrongheadedness that Ishmael Reed, again, a man, a writer who I really respect. But I just think, since Obama's election, he's taken a turn, I don't know, just towards ideas that aren't very helpful. And what is at the heart of his argument is that somehow he thinks that Trump is worse than Biden. And I don't think, particularly if you look at what's happened since October 7th, for all of his flaws, and Trump is a horrible man. Don't get me wrong.
Yes, absolutely.
But I don't know that you can make the case that he's any more horrible than Joe Biden, who was subsidizing and encouraging a genocide in Gaza right now. And so, this op-ed was disappointing on a number of fronts. I think it really speaks to the failure of Black leadership. We have an older generation that is, I think, as your previous guest just pointed out, Dr. Wright, I think we have an older generation that is becoming increasingly detached from the people and from the struggles of the people. And so their ideas on a way forward are grounded in their estrangement from the community, particularly the Black community. And I think that's true increasingly. And I say this with deep, deep regret. I do, because I think both men have the potential and have a legacy that I think will be tarnished by recent events. But I think both men, Cornel West, Dr. Cornel West and Ishmael Reed, have unfortunately lost touch with the people to some extent. And neither really is offering the kind of ideas that we need in this really dire moment, right? This is not like any other moment in my lifetime, and I'm pushing 60, and I don't remember a moment that is as dire as this one, not just for Black people, but for America as a whole. I mean, we're at a crisis point, an inflection point, where the way forward is just not very clear. And I wish that Ishmael Reed and Dr. West were shining a little bit more light on the way forward for us.
So I want to hold that point or explore it a little bit more. And that's the point that, we're really in a dire situation. And again, as you said, not just Black folks, but the entire country, because I think that a lot of what we see, with our leaders, with our Renaissance folks, right? Everyday people, right? I think we are seeing or feeling, if not fear, definitely anxiety. And I think that is contributing to some of how we see us responding. And so just to give our readers, and especially since you gave me such a great segue about legacy, I'm just going to share a little bit at this time with our WPFW listeners, the op-ed. So indulge me, John, for just a moment. Dear Cornel, what will your legacy be? How will your children and grandchildren view you? Like you, I am concerned about the murder of civilians in Palestine, Haiti, and Sudan. I'm also worried about the lives of civilians in our country. You're polling at 4% in Michigan and 3% nationwide, enough to elect Donald Trump. Are you sure you want to help install a dictatorship? So his opening paragraph really gets to the point that you made, that this conversation isn't about, Trump and Biden and, how are you, how does your candidacy expose them as lesser candidates, as problematic in policy, but really focuses on how this narrative of vote blue no matter who, keeps reiterating, keeps repeating and echoing, particularly among the Black community. Like, what am I reading that wrong? Am I misreading that?
No, I think the Black elite repeats that narrative of vote blue no matter who. And I think they also repeat this narrative, I heard it just a few weeks ago with a dear friend of mine who was by no means a dumb woman. But she repeats the narrative of, you know, Trump poses a risk to our democracy. I don't see it. I take the democracy. I'm not sure democracy has ever existed in this country. If it did, it was only during the period between, I would say, roughly, you know, 1935 and 1975, when you had a radical Black political movement that was very much involved in our nation's politics, both on a national level and on a grassroots level. And I don't see a democracy. The United States, the people in the United States have, since 1980, a majority, sometimes as high as 75%, the majority have wanted a single-payer healthcare system. No matter what you call it, you call it socialized medicine, and still a plurality at least want that. The polls show that people want that in America, and we don't have it. So, and this is true for so many things. How many people want us to be spending all this money, billions of dollars, in Ukraine, as opposed to on education, on healthcare, infrastructure? And yet they're throwing money at Ukraine, throwing good money after bad in Ukraine. How many people want this genocide, want us to be involved in this genocide in Gaza? And yet we're doing it. So I would challenge the basic notion that Donald Trump is any more of a threat to our democracy than any other president has been. One of the things that Ishmael Reed mentions in his piece was Social Security and the threat that Trump poses to Social Security. He most certainly does. But the closest that we've come to abolishing Social Security or ending Social Security since it was created in 1935, I believe, was during the Obama administration when he appointed a blue ribbon panel that really proposed some very hard-hitting measures to reform, really break Social Security. So I just challenge the basic notion that democracy is any more under threat with Donald Trump than it is with Joe Biden.
When we look at that concept or that thought that one is worse than the other, and our willingness to, because you know we did it once with Biden, and you know, and it looks like we'll do it again. When we are looking at, again, one as being worse than the other, what is it that you think we really fear? Are we all just, and I say all as this very loose sort of collective, because there are many people who think that Trump is just, you know, the worst thing since sliced bread. And I don't disagree with that. I think, you know, we've seen his antics. We know who he is. He's, you know, the interesting thing about Trump is that Trump will show you who he is. There is never any guessing, right? Never any guessing about that. He shows you.
He is transparent.
Very transparent about who he is. So when you say, I just think that, you know, he is, you know, awful at this, or he just is not what we need as a country, I don't think that that's a false statement at all. But I'm wondering what is it that we fear most about, you know, electing, having served as president, having endured it, and survived it. So I am curious, what do you think that we fear the most about having him in office versus having him in office again versus having Biden in office again?
Wow, that's a great question, Denise. I have to be honest. I think that a lot of this is driven, and this is probably a much too conversation that's much too deep to have at this early in the morning. But
right,
I think
right.
a lot of this is driven by our elites, by our investment class, by the political class, the oligarchs, if you will. They don't care that Trump, you know, is openly racist, or that he refers to countries as S-hole countries, or kids in cage. They don't, because you can't find any quantifiable difference between Donald Trump's policies and Joe Biden's policies, except in one key regard, and that is this. Joe Biden is enthusiastic about starting wars. Donald Trump, for all of his failures, he did not go into Ukraine, or he did not at least stir up this war in Ukraine. He did not even stir up antagonism with Russia. He did with China, but not with Russia. He's not responsible for genocide, right? He might be when he gets back in office, which I believe he will, but he's not responsible for genocide. Ask yourself this, how does the United States, its political class, its investment class, how does it make its money these days? Well, it makes its money not off of industry, not off of building automobiles or, you know, anything in these smokestack industries. It makes its money through war profiteering. And that is what I think the wealthy particularly, they need Joe Biden in office because he's enthusiastic. The Democratic Party is enthusiastic about starting wars. Trump is a bit more ambivalent, it seems. But the problem is that, you know, we basically have like, you know, two people in the entire country who own all of the media, right? And this idea of Trump as, you know, the real danger, a danger to our democracy, or what are we going to do? And, you know, it's really, I hate to say this because I know I sound like, you know, someone who sees the black helicopters and a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, they say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean nobody's out to get you. So I do think, though, that it's almost a form of mind control where people have so little access to other information. Like, how many people know that the war in Ukraine is already lost? Russia has won, clearly, right? It's all over but the shouting. And you won't know this if you look at CNN and MSNBC, as I often do, right? Only to sort of learn what everyone else is learning, only to understand what everyone else is learning. So this is really the problem, is that we don't have a real effective media. We have an equally ineffective educational system, and we've got this consolidation of media ownership. And so the common people, right? I don't mean common in a
particular sense. Right, no, I know.
We take our cues from the elites. And so this is the problem. There's no quantitative difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, except in terms of their eagerness, their enthusiasm to start and finance wars.
Okay. Well, one other question before we go to break. So we have that one sort of quantifiable measure. What about this idea of, you know, sort of, you know, a more of the racist populations being more emboldened to, I mean, you know, and I guess what we would be looking at is Trump's base, but really looking sort of at that population as being more emboldened with him in office and what they are willing to do. We saw with the insurrection, but also just in terms of within, you know, our communities, you know, whether we feel safer or less safe, I should say, with them. Like, is that something that is, that we should, is that a legitimate claim?
I think there's some truth to that. I think you can make the argument that Trump's voters are more animated to commit violence than they would be under Joe Biden. But I think the difference is marginal, and it's sort of thinking about which of these two white supremacists, because Joe Biden is a white supremacist, I don't care what you say.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we think about, well, which one of these white supremacists should we pick, right? I think we should grasp the problem at the root, right? That's the meaning of the word radical, as Malcolm taught us, right?
Yes.
And say, you know, it's not exactly as though Joe Biden has stopped the bleeding, literally, right, in the black community of police officers and other vigilantes, these microaggressions we see all the time on YouTube. You know, what we saw last summer in Alabama at that boat, the docks there.
Yes.
You know, and so,
even having to respond to George Floyd's murder, you know, with the official Juneteenth holiday. So absolutely, we understand that we are seeing, or we haven't stopped the bleeding. So
yeah, and so Joe Biden really just placates or makes an effort to placate the suffering and the grievances of legitimate grievances, particularly of the Black community, but he doesn't do anything about it. And so, you know, if you say, you know, under Donald Trump, it might be 100 casualties, and under Biden might be 90. I don't think you're really making a strong argument that Joe Biden is the answer.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we are going to take a break, and we are going to do just a little bit of a pivot on this conversation, because you mentioned something very interesting, and that is about not having a strong media. And Ishmael Reed mentions that a little bit in his op-ed. So you're listening to What's at Stake on WPFW, and we'll be right back after the station break.
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 22nd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 7th to the 12th, at AFI Silver Theater and Culture Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema, with 15 films representing 10 Caribbean countries. Highlights include discussions with filmmakers and Caribbean refreshments. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 7th to the 12th, scheduled at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake on WPFW. So I am here this morning talking with John Jeter about the op-ed from Ishmael Reed to Dr. Cornel West. John, before we go on, I want to actually share with our listeners a bit of a clip from an interview that Don Lemon conducted with Dr. Cornel West, I believe the day after the op-ed came out. So if we can go to that clip.
Being a spoiler, because you know folks are saying, hey, Cornel West is just being a spoiler, because it shows that Robert Kennedy Jr. is pulling more people from Donald Trump, right? And you and Jill Stein are pulling more people from Joe Biden. And your chances of winning, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be in this, but you you're realistic about your chances of winning. But do you feel like you're going to be a spoiler and that you are helping to elect Donald Trump, who I know you don't agree with?
Well, no, I mean, he's dead up fascist. There's no doubt about that. But you got to keep in mind, my brother, that every politician has to make their case and earn people's votes. There's no entitlement here. There's no ownership of votes. If people once voted for Biden and end up voting for Trump, Trump was not a spoiler. People decided Trump. If people once decided for Biden and decided that he's got policies they no longer agree with and they go with me, I'm not a spoiler either. People are thinking for themselves and reaching their conclusions. You see? Mm-hmm. So that the idea that somehow people are spoilers because all we have are two candidates. And you see, if your assumption is there's no alternative whatsoever to the corporate duopoly, then anybody is. Libertarians, are they spoilers? No, they're making their case. And keep in mind, 40% of Americans don't vote at all.
Yeah. Right?
And you got 62% of Americans say they will never, ever, ever, ever vote for the two dominant parties. So that, where does spoiling come in here? The whole discourse is spoiling.
But Dr. West, we hear that every time from a third party candidate. And I guess Ross Perot was the only one that came the closest. We hear that. Look, and I'm not trying to discourage you from running, but I'm just living.
No, I hear you.
Have to live in reality.
Absolutely.
We hear that every single time, you know, that, you know, the third party candidate, they should be able to. And it just seems like a protest candidacy or protest vote that ends up giving the vote to the person that you would rather not have in office. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because I know if the choice is, if you weren't in this, let me ask you this, if you weren't in this, would it be Biden or would it be Trump?
Oh, I would never vote for either one. How could I vote for a fascist and a genocide denier and genocide enabler? It's like asking the free Negroes in Philadelphia in the 1850s, you got a choice between a liberal slaveholder and a conservative slaveholder. Which one are you going through with Johnson? Hey, I don't vote for slaveholders. I'm going to vote for the Liberty Party. That was the third party of that day, right? That's what Frederick Douglass was working on. That's what his sister was working on, the one and only Harriet Tubman and others. Now, of course, they couldn't vote because of the white supremacy and the slaveocratic character of America at that time.
So, I watched that interview, and I have to say that I really, really appreciated Dr. Cornel West's response, particularly to that question. What are your thoughts about it?
I think that clip, I agree with you. I think that clip really illustrates the promise of Dr. Cornel West and why I personally, and many of the people I know, were also very excited when he first announced his candidacy for the Green Party. But I also think it shows why we're so frustrated with his campaign that doesn't seem to have any direction, that has, frankly, not just that Cornel West left the Green Party, but that he doesn't seem to have a strategy for running a third party campaign. He's, the Green Party would have afforded him access to most of the states in terms of ballot access.
Yes.
Why he left, I don't completely understand. He's been critical of Jill Stein, and that's fine, right? I don't know Jill Stein from Adam. I'll be honest with you. I'd probably vote for her of all the candidates right now because I think she has the best chance of building a third party which could become viable. But, you know, he's turned on people like Ajamu Baraka, who was one of the, was in the Green Party, was the vice presidential nominee of the party in 2016. And I'm really frustrated with Dr. West. There's a group of young brothers who do a podcast, Revolutionary Black Network or something like that. And they are even more frustrated than me. They refer to Dr. West as Cornball West. And they say that their anger, they say, is because this is an opportunity. This was an opportunity for a third party to really begin to change the conversation, to elevate the conversation. And they believe that West, and they're saying this, but I don't completely disagree. I just don't maybe have the information they have, but they think that West has really sabotaged this effort to change, to elevate the conversation, which is the predicate for change, elevating that conversation.
Right.
And that West has squandered that, and that it's really for self-serving reasons. And I would be hard-pressed to disagree with that from what I know. Maybe I don't have all the information, but it does seem like this campaign has been more self-serving than it has been sort of outward-looking and looking to be transformative for the nation.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to continue. I mean, well, things will unfold and certainly reveal themselves. Now, when I was watching the interview, I know that one of the things that he said about the Green Party, which I thought was very interesting, and I am not necessarily in disagreement of it, but one of the things that he said in his interview with Don Lemon is that he felt like the Green Party did not have a specific space to talk about predatory capitalism and white supremacy, because it has been so focused on environment and climate. So I think that that's at least a consideration. But one of the things that I wanted to get back to with your comment about not having media is or strong media is actually something that Ishmael Reed stated in his open letter to Cornel West, and which is what he said. Even though you might tip the election, you have avoided the scrutiny you'd receive if a strong Black press existed. Will you have a press conference to answer the questions raised by Masiotra and the New Republic? Will those Black public intellectuals found acceptable by the media remain silent about your bid? And this is another reason that I wanted to talk to you about this have this conversation with you, John, is because, as a journalist, what are your thoughts about, his point that, you really have not had the scrutiny that is needed to really hold you and your campaign accountable?
Yeah, I you know, that's really interesting because it I did want to respond to your point you just made about the Green Party.
About the Green Party.
I don't disagree that the Green Party is not a revolutionary or radical Black party,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
there's no question about that.
Yes.
They're led by a range of people, mostly white, who are somewhere from liberal to radical, liberal to progressive, if you will.
Right.
I thought, and I think a lot of people thought, that Cornel West would actually, again, elevate the conversation. He would be the one who imbued the party.
That.
Right. I mean, he's such a strong personality. Clearly, he's a scholar. He's a very smart man. He's one of the best communicators out there. I would say he's the left version of Tucker Carlson, meaning that he's the best person who can communicate the values and the ideas of the left. So I thought he would do that. In the same vein, I think that, you know, had he run a campaign that was much stronger than the one he's running, that he could have changed. He could have begun to change.
Got to change the Green Party
in the media, right? Like the media, I think, would have to keep up with him to cover his campaign. If it had been what I thought it should be or would be, then the media would have to raise its level of play, right? I mean, these things don't happen all at once. The media is so horrific now that it's hard to sort of see it. It's like a tanker, right? You can't turn a tanker like on a dime. So it would take, you know, years certainly to raise this level of play. You have to really, you know, see almost a new media in place. But I thought that Cornel West was positioned to really start to challenge institutions like the media, like the academy. I just think that, this campaign has really been very frustrating. His campaign has been very, very frustrating. And Ishmael Reed, I wish, had pointed out these kinds of questions rather than this idea of, you know, Cornel being a spoiler for the Joe Biden.
I think that, you know, because part of the problem with this idea of being a spoiler, right, narrows the conversation. But it also has implications for Black voters, right? And at some point in our community, and this is beyond, you know, what we see, what we hear from our leaders and the other elected officials and et cetera, is that within our own communities, right, when do we begin to have the conversation that the lesser of two evils is still what? Evil. Like, when do we begin to have those conversations? And I know that many people are trying to have those conversations, but you go out on social media and I tell you, if you post about, you know, hey, listen, we really need to talk about this two-party thing that is happening in our allegiance to the Democratic Party and how, you know, and Cornel West said it earlier about nobody's being a spoiler. The idea is that everybody who is running for office is supposed to be earning people's votes. And so if we continue to have within our collective this conversation that is so one-sided, that really, I think, depicts a fear, a political fear. I don't want to say political cowardice because I don't want to put my people out there like that, but it definitely is a political fear, and it's fear mongering when we continue to say, basically, you know, the world's going to end, you know, if you get one candidate in versus the other. And so I agree that I thought that Cornel West would. Certainly, he has the mind. He is, as you said, an incredible, incredible thinker. Like his thinking is revolutionary, right? And so I think one of the challenges is when you have to put that into practice in something as practical as a campaign, what does that look like? And, you know, we would have to go to, you know, as examples, probably, I would think, we'd have to be looking and studying, and you mentioned this earlier, we'd have to be looking and studying our mayoral right, campaigns where we had, you know, very radical folks. And you talk about this all the time, John. So it's not just, you know, Mayor Washington, but Marion Barry, who, I think was, you know, probably wrote the blueprint on that. But those are the kinds of campaigns that we would have to be looking at. Obviously, you know, you have one on a local level and then a national level, and there are obvious differences, but really looking at those very basic strategies, and then how do you scale them to a national campaign? What do we do as a collective? Because people are now talking a little bit about this, because I actually found the op-ed on social media that it was posted. No comments, interestingly enough, when someone posted it. But, you know, now that this is in our hands, you know, like, what do we do with this? What do we do with the op-ed? And as Black voters, what do we do with this?
You know, Malcolm talked about how before you could organize the people, an organization, grassroots organizing is the key to everything. It is the predicate for change in this country and every other country, right?
Yes.
Change comes from the bottom up. It's the poorest people, the most oppressed people in your society who are the engine for change. Who is that? Well, in the United States, that's us. You could argue that's because they murdered all the indigenous people. But that's us. That's Black
people. It is us. Yes.
And so your city, your hometown, Denise, is the pinnacle of that idea, right? Harold Washington, coalition, it was mostly Black, but they call it a rainbow coalition, right?
Right.
Grassroots organizing, which was modeled on Fred Hampton's idea of a rainbow coalition.
Yes.
And what did that do? That sparked Jesse Jackson's 84 and 88. Presidential campaigns, which, you know, you can say whatever you want about Jesse Jackson, but those two campaigns were transformative, right?
Yeah.
If we continued in that direction, unfortunately, the movement was hijacked by Bill Clinton and Al Gore and the Democratic Leadership Council, Council, and the white supremacists like Joe Biden in the Democratic Party. Moved to the right. Now they're right of the Democrats, right? Because Bill Clinton made the decision that they would compete with the Republicans, with Ronald Reagan's party, for white suburban voters by being more racist than the Republicans. That was a very clear decision he made. So here's what I would say that we need to do. This is what I believe that Black people particularly, and really all working people, but certainly Black people, we need to study our history. Our future will not be in our past, but we've done some things in the past that should inform our actions moving forward. What happened in Chicago with Harold Washington? Why did they kill Fred Hampton? Right? They didn't just kill him because they didn't like him. They killed him because he was organizing. He was bringing people together. He was actually disciplining white people's fears and anxieties and racism, and saying, "Man, I'm not your enemy, right? I'm not your biggest problem. Your biggest problem is that white man who owns everything, right? That's your problem, not me." Yes. And that's what he came. So we need to study our history. What has worked? What has not worked? Why are we having this conversation about Donald Trump and Joe Biden and nothing else, right? Why are we not talking about again back to Chicago? One of the most industrialized cities in the history of the world. Why are we not talking about this post-industrial society that we live in, where we make nothing of value, and the only way to make money is by loan sharking, right? Finance. So this is what we need to do. I think we need to educate ourselves, get beyond the media. Maybe that's it too. Maybe it is expanding, and maybe this is a private conversation that we need to have. Expanding. Media, particularly in our communities, to talk about these issues from the ground up so that we could organize around these issues and build upon that. Because, and again, it's the last thing I'll say, it's very much like Fred Hampton said, right? You win your freedom when you can take people from one phase to another phase to another phase, right? Yes, that's revolution, right? It's not like you just snap your fingers you throw a punch. It's a fight, right?
It's a
15 round fight, right? And you're not gonna win a round and think, hey, it's over. And that's right. What we did. You know, that was our problem. We won one round, you know, basically in the early 70s, you could say we won a round. Right. We thought it was over, and they came back, and they, hey, look, this is painful for me to admit as a 59-year-old black man, but they whipped our tinies. And so The question is, you know, we need to take that behind whooping and say, okay, how are we going to win these next few rounds?
How are we going to win these next few rounds? Because we are definitely still in the struggle, and we got to understand that this is not going away. So we got to get back in that ring.
No question.
John, thank you so much. I appreciate you. What's at Stake listeners, thank you for joining us this morning. Thank you to our guests, Dr. Denise Wright and John Jeter. Always a pleasure. Thanks to executive producer, Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. Thank you. I'm Denise Young. May we continue to be truth and justice seekers. And stay tuned for our next show, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams.
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. That's CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 22nd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 7th to the 12th at AFI Silver Theater and Culture Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with 15 films representing 10 Caribbean countries. Highlights include discussions with filmmakers and Caribbean refreshments. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 7th to the 12th, scheduled at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Pacifica National Board and the WPFW Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica Bylaws Amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the pacifica.org website.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
The DC Black Fathers Matter Project, 5th Annual Father's Day Motorcade, Saturday, June 15th. The motorcade honoring black fathers will depart at 12 noon from the African American Civil War Museum at 1925 Vermont Avenue Northwest. Arrival is as early as 10:30 a.m. to participate. The motorcade will end at the Big Chair on Martin Luther King Avenue and V Street Southeast at approximately 1 p.m. DC residents are encouraged to display banners or posters in your neighborhood, community, or church. Beginning Friday, June 14th, in honor of Black Fathers. More info at 202-240-1182. That's 202-240-1182 or dcblackhistory.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Thank you to the following for providing food for our phone volunteers.